The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Well, I'm delighted that we're joined today by one of Britain's favourite broadcasters, very well known from his big hit show on LBC Radio, and also for his podcast, and here to talk about his new book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind. James O'Brien, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Matt. It's a pleasure.
James, to talk about your book, I actually want to start with something that's in the news today, which I think might actually be helpful to the discussion we're going to have. And it was a tweet that you put out this morning about Marcus Rashford. In it, you wrote, there are two types of people in the world. One, people who look at Marcus Rashford's timeline and feel a combination of warmth, concern and gratitude. Two, people who look at Marcus Rashford's timeline and feel compelled to sneer about virtue signalling. We're governed by the latter. Now, before we go into that in detail, could you just maybe explain a little bit to our listeners, if they're not familiar with the Manchester United footballer, what he's doing off the pitch at present, which has become such a big story in Britain?
Of course. Well, it began over the summer when Marcus Rashford, who benefited from free school meals as a child, started highlighting the plight of children who get them during term time but don't get them during the school holidays. And the government in Westminster was adamant that they wouldn't extend the offer to the lockdown period when, you know, children couldn't be at school for obvious reasons, and that meant they weren't going to get their school dinners. And in about 24 hours, which by Boris Johnson's standards is quite quick for a U-turn, they always happen in the end, but the 24 hours is a fairly short space of time, they rolled over and introduced legislation to make sure that children did get fed during lockdown. And then Marcus Rashford, the Manchester United player, last week sought to see that extended into the Easter holidays, because although the Christmas holidays, because although children aren't in lockdown anymore, you still don't get fed. You don't get the free meal, which works out about 15 quid a week during the school holidays. So he was keen to see that extended. The Welsh government has done it, the Scottish government has done it, but the English government has refused and continues to do so. And he has subsequently used his Twitter account to sort of marshal this astonishing effort today. It's been amazing to watch and quite emotional, whereby businesses, most obviously those in the hospitality sector, restaurants, cafes, which will, of course, themselves be struggling under the privations of various tier restrictions, and crucially councils. And when I say councils, amazingly, I don't just mean the ones you might expect to fall behind in, like Liverpool, who came in very early with, I think, 20,000 children. But I noticed not long ago that Kensington and Chelsea Council, which is a sort of jewel in the crown of Big C conservatism, has also now pledged that just over 5,000 children in that borough, in the royal borough of Kensington and Chelsea, will get it as well. And it's an astonishing example, regardless of what you think about whether or not government should or shouldn't be doing it, just to see somebody taking it upon themselves to bring improvement into the lives of potentially millions of people that he will never even meet, simply because he knows from personal experience that it is the right thing to do. Not long ago, I would have thought that pretty much everybody would be cheering that to the rafters. But we live in a world now where some people will strain to see a negative in it. And there was one MP in particular 2 days ago standing up in the House of Commons who described it as celebrities' virtue signalling on Twitter. So even when they actually produce the goods, there's still a temptation for a certain type of politician, and of course a certain type of punter as well, follows soon after, to frame everything as a negative. So it's been really lovely to see it.
Indeed. So that's why it does actually fit in, doesn't it, to your book. There is this class, or there's this type of person in British society at present who does seem to always be certain in their own viewpoints, never willing to concede that other people might have a superior point of view.
Yes, I think we're all guilty of that, Matt, to be honest. The book I've written is more personal than political, but it's certainly born of confusion and frustration at people's inability, I think, rather than failure. It's an inability to climb down from very strongly held opinions, even when all of the evidence available should be, you know, contradicting and even refuting those positions and opinions. And I call it footballification, because it's as if politically many, many, many people have started judging an action by the shirt colour of the perpetrator as opposed to the content of the action itself, which is how you can end up cheering identical behaviours when it's done by your quote-unquote side and booing it furiously when it's done by the other quote-unquote side. And obviously this is unsustainable. We can't carry on like this because it will send us all potty.
How do we get to there, though?
Well, for me, it's Brexit in this country. Donald Trump in America displays almost identical traits. But for me, it's because Brexit was such an evidence-free debate. It all transcended into emotion and feeling and the stoking up of xenophobia, the weaponizing of essentially meaningless slogans that became blunt instruments, which you didn't have to understand whether they meant anything or not in order to hit the other fella over the head with them. So Brexit means Brexit. No deal is better than a bad deal. Let's go WTO. This is all post-referendum results, but it's all following, for me, fast upon the fact that the referendum result was achieved by weaponizing xenophobia and sticking a massive lie on the side of a bus. And because it was so emotional, it's tied up in people's identity now rather than traditional politics or more traditional politics. And the leave-remain divide holds true across some of the coronavirus-related controversies, and it, for me at least, holds true right through to the Marcus Rashford story that we're talking about today. Because Boris Johnson is the embodiment of Brexit, because people aren't ready to admit yet that Brexit isn't going to deliver any of the glittering prizes that they not only were promised it would deliver, but which they believed it would deliver, and because they can't admit that was a terrible mistake yet, they have to sort of paint Boris Johnson still in the colours of correctness, even as the evidence of his wrongness mounts, so their desperation to cling to the carcass of his reputation continues. And that's why when he decides that they're not going to feed hungry school children, they have to line up behind him and start attacking hungry schoolchildren, or indeed the parents of the hungry schoolchildren. So something really illustrative happened this week in Britain, where on Monday morning, some very skewed and disingenuous research was published showing that white working class boys have fallen behind black working class boys in English schools in particular, British schools in general. And the wailing and the gnashing of teeth on that day was supposedly supportive of white working class boys. But by Wednesday, when Marcus Rashford was pointing out that white and indeed any other colour of working class boy, the poorest, were going hungry, suddenly we segue in the space of 48 hours from this being an enormous national tragedy of which we should all feel deeply ashamed when they're doing worse than black boys in school, to telling them to, you know, suck it up and blame it all on their feckless, work-shy parents when it's reported that they're hungry. So the dangers of the hypocrisy that's tied up in this blind tribalism have rarely been clearer than in that little three-day journey.
James, your radio programme has a lot of contributions from phone-in guests, and there was one line that really jumped out to me from your book, and I'm just going to read it out for the listeners. It's perhaps best summarised by an English caller married to an Indian woman who explained to me in the middle of 2019 that he knew his political hero was a liar, a racist, and a fraud, but that he offered him full-throated support, that he actively enjoyed being lied to, because it upsets people like you.
Yeah.
Now, what do you make of that?
Well, what do you make of it? It's insane, right? But it's important to understand it. Actually, the full quote, which I didn't put in the book because it wouldn't have added anything, was, it upsets people like you and Sadiq Khan. With him, I mean, I might have a bit in common politically, but obviously in terms of ethnicity, background, religion, and all the other labels that we like to stick on each other, I have nothing in common with him at all. So I think that's the apotheosis of what we've just been discussing, this idea that if it hurts me, then it's good, even if it's not true. And I get painted as a sort of paragon of liberal virtue signalling. So even though the example was Donald Trump, it was when he was in London and he was on screen claiming that there were no protests outside. And you could see the protest on another screen. You know what it's like in a newsroom. You've got two or three different feeds coming in. So on one feed, you've got Donald Trump giving a speech from behind a podium. And outside the doors of the building that he's in, there's hundreds of people protesting and waving their placards around. And he's standing there straight down the barrel of the camera claiming that there aren't any protests at all. A lie so egregious that you kind of can't help remembering Orwell's warning about the people were told to ignore the evidence of their eyes and ears. It was the party's final, most terrible command. And here we were in 2019, having thought that Orwell was either describing a world that was past or issuing a warning that would never be needed. Here we are watching it unfold on our television screens in real time. So that guy haunts me, Steve his name was. And the idea, I don't know now whether the fact that he's been essentially misled over our coronavirus handling in this country or over a whole heap of other enormous issues that will have a deleterious effect on his life. But I don't know now whether or not he would still derive pleasure from the fact that those of us who screamed warnings from the rooftop have been proved more or less incontrovertibly right.
I want to go back to this footballification that you mentioned earlier, because you argued that the most enthusiastic proponents of it, at its simplest, just can't process the existence of people who refuse to join any team in the first place.
Yes.
And you use the context of the last British general election, which to many of us in Ireland looked at you were faced with the most appalling choice imaginable. You had, how has Britain come to the stage where your choice was Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn? I mean, it's bad enough in the United States at present, but Joe Biden at least seems to be a well-formed, intelligent, decent individual, if not particularly inspiring. How did Britain get to Johnson and Corbyn being your two main political leaders?
Oh, man. I very, very briefly, I think Biden is probably more inspiring than we give him credit for. It's just that this lens of coverage now is so obsessed with both sidedism and false equivalence that it knocks some of the gloss off him. But some of his interactions, particularly with younger Americans, are quite beautiful. And I'm conscious of answering all of your brilliant questions by just shouting Brexit from the rooftops. But obviously, I mean, Corbyn got a second bite of the cherry after losing the election to Theresa May, which in normal times would have been sandwiches wrapped in a roadmap territory for almost anybody, I think. But he got a second bite of the cherry because he did better than people expected in that general election. He certainly did better than Theresa May and her advisers expected him to do. But I think it's fairly clear that that was because he was, it turned out, wrongly perceived as the best chance of slamming the brakes on Brexit, the best chance of getting a second referendum. So Corbyn had an awful lot of reluctant Remainers voting for him in 2017. But by the time 2019 came around, it had become pretty clear that he was not the Messiah. He was just a very naughty boy. And as such, he was indeed the rock to Boris Johnson's hard place. But the passage you read out refers to the fact that some people refuse to let you be dismayed by both options. So I found myself in a very odd position of being routinely attacked by the right-wing media. The Sun in particular went after me with particular vitriol because I was a fairly outspoken critic of both Brexit and latterly Boris Johnson. But Jeremy Corbyn's most committed fans didn't care how much I criticised or produced evidence-based critiques of Boris Johnson. The fact that I wasn't slavishly cheering Jeremy Corbyn to the rafters and had the audacity to point out some of his problems with regard to anti-Semitism, most obviously, was evidence that actually I wanted the Tories to win the election. So the really mystery constituency in British politics at the moment are people who don't have a team. We have to vote, you know. I'm lucky enough to be able to vote for a constituency MP who I know and admire, so I could put my ex in the Labour box. But I genuinely would have struggled to make a strong case for wanting either one or the other to prevail in that election. I kind of wanted it to be a score draw, but we are where we are with an 80-seat majority, so a man whose oven-ready deal has already been pulled apart by his own need to pass legislation allowing him to break it. It is absolutely bonkers. I find Irish media helpful as a reminder of what reality actually looks like from the outside, because from the inside, it's very, very, very easy to lose sight of what's actually going on.
Well, just to finish, James O'Brien, very briefly, if Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings and others were to pick up How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind, do you think that they might change their mind on all the things that they've been doing?
I take it right back to basic. I take it back to 10-year-old me. And I know a lot of Irish fellows in particular who perhaps were taught by Christian brothers or other clerics. I take it right back to some of the brutalisation that was visited upon me at boarding school. And I explain why that led me to live much of my life with my fists up and what I thought was my skin turned out to be a suit of armor. And when you start digging into the reasons behind your stubbornness and your inability to ever admit that you're wrong, and crucially, your conviction that you can talk and bargain your way out of almost anything. And I spent much of my life not just believing that, but succeeding as a basis of that belief. But then I realized, for reasons I explained, that it just doesn't work. So maybe, just maybe, if they were to dig into the roots of their own intransigence and the roots of their own superiority complexes, they might begin to admit the possibility that they haven't got the answers to the problems that they're currently charged with solving.
James O'Brien, terrific having you on the programme. Thank you very much. The book is called How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.